Kelly.
Thank you. May it please the court, I represent Leonard Davis in this appeal from a judgment that dismissed his petition for a writ of habeas corpus. The question presented on appeal is whether the Wisconsin Court of Appeals unreasonably applied clearly established precedent when it held that Mr. Davis was not entitled to an in-camera inspection of records that were in the state's possession and that pertained to the mental health of the complaining witness in his sexual assault trial. Our position is that the Court of Appeals held Davis to a much higher standard than the standard articulated in Ritchie, in fact, held him to a standard that is impossible to meet.
Is that an unreasonable application, or is that simply getting the law wrong?
Difficult to determine which of those it is. To an extent, they're getting the law wrong because they, although they make reference in their decision to Ritchie, which would imply that they at least knew that there was a standard.
In a very tangential sort of way.
I'm sorry?
In a very tangential.
Very tangential. Sort of way. And I think it could be analyzed under either prong of
your basic point is they applied the wrong standard.
They applied the wrong standard. They created their own standard.
They required a degree of specificity which Ritchie simply rejects.
Exactly.
That's your point.
That's my point.
Okay.
And whether that's applying the wrong standard or unreasonably applying the Ritchie standard, I think gets us to the same place. I think this analysis proceeds from a few simple questions. The first is, was the law clearly established by the United States Supreme Court? I think Ritchie answers that question. Ritchie held that as a matter of due process, a defendant who makes a plausible showing that records in the state's possession may be material to the defense is entitled to an in-camera inspection.
What does that mean, Mr. Kelly, in the state's possession? I understand these records were not in the possession of the prosecutorial authorities, am I correct?
That is correct, and I think that brings us to the Brady line of cases, which basically say it doesn't have to be in the district attorney's office, it has to be in the possession of the government. And that was true in Ritchie, where the Supreme Court said that the prosecutor in Ritchie did not have and had not reviewed the CYF records. The records were actually in the possession of a state agency, CYF, and not in the possession of the prosecution. We have the same situation here. The records we want to have reviewed are in the possession of the Department of Corrections, essentially, and had not apparently been in the possession of the district attorney's office.
What do you do with our Hatch case, H-A-C-H, which seems to indicate that the records have to be in the control of the prosecutorial authorities?
I don't think that is the holding of Ritchie, because Ritchie said that Mr. Ritchie was entitled to an in-camera inspection of records that were in the government's possession, and specifically in the possession of CYF, which was the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Child and Youth Services Agency.
So Hatch may have misspoken?
At least in this context, I think it did, yes.
How would, in getting back to your case,
yes.
How would anyone have gotten these records from the, for instance, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections?
I think the judge would have ordered the Department of Corrections to produce them, and the Department of Corrections is an arm of the state, so I think the judge had authority to do that.
At the at trial, did anyone ask him to do that?
There was a pretrial motion asking for an in-camera inspection.
I see, and so your view is that encompassed within that motion would have been a request to the judge to do what was necessary to procure the documents for the in-camera inspection.
I believe so. I don't think there was any question raised at the pretrial motion as to the impossibility of obtaining those records or any lack of judicial authority to obtain the records. The request was that the records be reviewed by the court.
Could those records have been obtained without the consent of the victim?
I think at least as to things like psychological or drug and alcohol treatment records, probably not, because there would be a privilege attached to those records.
Is that what State Against FH says, or does it indicate that that evidentiary privilege would have to be weighed against the need for the records in this particular case?
State Against
SH, that it's the Wisconsin case that deals with the issue?
Oh. I guess I'd have to go back and look at FH more specifically, but I think the proposition here is that obviously Mr. Davis was asking for an in-camera inspection of the records. The judge wasn't saying, you don't need me, you can just subpoena these records. I know from my personal experience that if you subpoena Department of Corrections records where a privilege would attach, the Department of Corrections isn't going to give you those records, and I assume that's why Davis went this route instead of trying to subpoena the records.
But the appellate court in Wisconsin seemed to think it could get the records if the appropriate showing was made, I guess.
The appellate court seemed to think that there are cases in which an in-camera review of the records would be justified, but they said that Davis hadn't met the standard in this case. Mm-hmm. And the standard that they asked him to meet was essentially to allege that the records contained evidence of a delusional illness or reported incidents where Melody, the complaining witness, had confused reality. That's a standard, of course, that Mr. Davis couldn't meet because he couldn't allege what was in records he had never seen. And the Supreme Court in Ritchie dealt with that issue. The Supreme Court said that at this stage of the proceedings, Ritchie can't tell us what's in the records because he hasn't seen them, the prosecutor hasn't seen them, the judge hasn't reviewed them. Nobody knows what's in those records. But they nonetheless held that because Ritchie had said that those files might contain favorable information, Ritchie was entitled to an in-camera inspection of the records. Essentially, the court said that Ritchie made a plausible showing of materiality. And that's not the standard that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals adopted in this case.
And what was the showing that your client made at trial that you think was adequate to meet that Ritchie standing of making a plausible showing?
He said, first of all, that they had information that Melody Vance was seeing people who didn't actually exist. So there was information that she may be delusional. That she had many psychological evaluations that had been ordered by the Department of Corrections while she was under Department of Corrections supervision. That she had a history of drug abuse. And that they had expert testimony available to the effect that a combination of drug abuse and mental disorders may have impaired her ability to perceive and relate to
the argument was when you combine her present state on that evening with the pre-existing disability, which might have made her more susceptible to delusional conduct that night or delusional experiences that night, they had a right to see if those records would substantiate that defense. Am I right?
Yes, and I think even more than that, just the fact that she had a number of psychological evaluations that the Department of Corrections thought were necessary certainly allows the inference that she has some serious mental health problems, and that goes to her reliability.
Would that be true of almost any criminal case when you decided that there had been some examination of mental capacity or mental illnesses of a complaining witness that she'd be entitled to ask for the in-camera review?
I don't know how often it comes up that a complaining witness in a criminal case has a history of mental health problems.
Neither do I, but supposing you take my word for it that it may come up more than once, it might have different people. People take advantage of people with mental disabilities frequently.
Sure.
My question then is it your position that once you know that the complaining witness has been examined by a psychiatrist or subjected to that sort of thing, that the defendant would be entitled to ask for and receive an in-camera review of that?
At least in a case like this one, yes, where there is information not only that she has received psychological evaluations, but that she may be seeing things that aren't there. I think that in itself calls into question her reliability. And under Giglio, if the state has information in its possession that
I thought your position was that since you didn't know it was in there, you were in no position to reach the standard. My question was, if you don't know what's in it, you might very well find that somebody is talking to people that aren't there and that sort of thing. No matter, even if you don't know what's in there at all, are you entitled to have somebody look to see whether that's there?
I think those might be closer cases, but I think, yeah, if you know that there's been an allegation or information that somebody has a mental health problem, and that person's going to be testifying. That should
that's
be
sufficient.
Yeah.
Mm. The mental health problem here involved delusional conduct.
Yeah. I see my time is up, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. We'll hear now from Ms. Prick.
Good morning, Your Honor. I think I'll start out by just attempting to answer the question that you posed earlier about what would happen if the court had, even in this case, ordered the psychological records for an in-camera review from the Department of Corrections. In that case, under Wisconsin law and under the confidentiality statutes, the victim in this case would have had to consent to the in-camera review. If she had not consented to the in-camera review, then the records would not have been reviewed and she would not have testified as a witness at the case.
So. Is that your reading of State against SH?
Yes, it is. And a line of cases, Holberg and several other cases in Wisconsin have said the same thing. At least that is where the law is at present in the state of Wisconsin.
But she would not have been able to testify?
She would not have been able to testify. That's correct.
So the state would have been without the evidence of the victim.
That's correct, yes. I'd like to step back a moment and recall that we're looking at this as a habeas review, and the first thing that Mr. Davis needs to prove is that the law is clearly established in this era, and I don't think he can do that. And he himself, in the Court of Appeals brief to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, said that Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, frankly, had no standard for the amount of evidence, the amount of showing that a defendant has to do in order to get in-camera review. I don't think that's exactly correct, but he said that in his brief to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. So it was not unusual or surprising that the Court of Appeals did not base their decision on Pennsylvania Ritchie in any prominent sense.
Yeah, that really, I mean, that is not a very good rendition of Pennsylvania against Ritchie, is it, by the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin?
I do not believe so, but the Wisconsin courts have been grappling with the Ritchie decision and trying to put some meat on the bones. The clause that we're dealing with that show that the Ritchie decision mentioned the standard of proof for having in-camera review is in footnote 15. It's hidden in footnote 15, even in the middle of it. The beginning of that footnote talks about disclosure. The end of the footnote talks about disclosure.
Well,
in the middle.
The Wisconsin trial judge says you learn a lot from footnotes.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. But there's not a lot of meat on the bones. Ritchie was decided after trial, not pre-trial. So their focus was on what the materiality showing to disclose them would be. And that's really the focus of the decision. It doesn't really give us a good handle on what any kind of preliminary showing would be. And the battle that's kind of gone back and forth between our briefs shows that there's a controversy over whether even Ritchie would have the ability to go back to the court on remand and argue that not Ritchie, Pennsylvania, and argue that there hadn't been a sufficient showing to go through all the records. So I think it's not absolutely clear. Then you have United States versus Hatch, which says it's really dicta because they decided that case really on there being no state action. But in a very similar situation to ours, in that there were drug treatment records that they wanted to get at, so
pretty
they doubted the maturity.
Pretty hard to reconcile that dicta with the Ritchie case, isn't it?
It's pretty hard to reconcile
the dicta in Hatch with the Ritchie case.
Yes, although I'm not sure that in Hatch that I read them to say that it has to be in the prosecutor's hands. They came out saying that there was no state action.
That is the bottom line in the opinion.
Yeah, and if there, I think that also shows that there's some confusion and that the law in Ritchie is not clearly established, because I think there is confusion about what is state action in these cases. Does it have to be in the prosecutor's hands? Does it have to be in a state can it be just in a state agency's hands? And I think there is some confusion over that. And again, shows that the law in this area is not clearly established. The Wisconsin courts have, since Ritchie came out, embraced Ritchie, and in fact, they've hatched notes that Wisconsin courts have expanded its application. So then in Wisconsin, it's not the question on whether there's state action or not. Under Wisconsin law is not a question because we've applied it.
But what, and applied it in other cases. But
yes.
But all that does is say that what we might have here is an opinion by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that really is an outlier. I mean, it doesn't fit comfortably within Ritchie. It doesn't fit comfortably within Wisconsin precedent and Wisconsin's reading of Ritchie. I mean, this particular panel and this particular case just got it wrong.
I don't think that's right. I think what you're dealing with, first of all, I want to back up in this. There really was no argument that this woman had a delusional illness. There was one statement in the motion saying she saw people in her apartment that were not there. That was never argued in the trial court. And you have to argue something with some prominence or else it's waived. And I believe that statement of delusional illness was waived. There was no argument she had a delusional illness. Even the cite in the motion that he cites to saying that she saw people that weren't there, it's not in the thing that he cited to in that motion. So I think basically what you had was a complaint that this woman, who, and many of these victims have these kind of problems, had an AODA problem, had depression, which the cult counsel said is not the kind of thing that when you misperceive a consensual sex as a sexual assault. There was no tying up what they wanted to get out of those records with what they thought might be in the records. Plus, both the Wisconsin courts and the district court in this area said there was no showing that he didn't have the evidence that he needed to impeach this witness. He had information about her drug use on that particular evening. She admitted to it. There were witnesses to her drug use on that evening. There was a party.
I think his argument is that drug use on that evening in this particular person would have had a far more profound effect than it would on most people because of her pre-existing disposition toward delusional situations.
But I don't think there was any evidence or any argument that she had a delusional illness. She had depression. That was the only mental illness that was ever mentioned. She was had a depression, which sometimes she poorly medicated. They did not argue delusional illness in the trial court. They did not argue delusional illness in the Court of Appeals. The co-counsel in this case, his co-defendant, said depression isn't the type of mental illness where you perceive things that don't happen. And I also really, before my time is up, I have to correct a strong misstatement that Mr. Davis's counsel made in his reply brief, and that is there was extreme evidence that this couldn't have been a consensual sex with all the injuries in the photographs, and he made the statement that the medical examiner had said in testimony that the injuries could have been gotten through consensual sex, and that just plain is not true. The medical examiner said she was shocked by the way this person looked when she saw her. She indicated 65 separate injuries this woman had. She indicated that the questioning came in the cross-examination down to the one injury, which is the injury in her vagina. And even at that, the medical examiner didn't say that this could come from consensual sex. The best he could get her to say is, well, it would have to have been pretty forceful. The record's there for you to look at, but I just really felt like I needed to correct that. I believe that in this case, first of all, that Pennsylvania versus Ritchie in deciding the quantum of the evidence that's needed to decide whether an in-camera is appropriate is not clearly established. And secondly, that the courts in Wisconsin have in their long body of law tried to put some meat on the bones of Pennsylvania versus Ritchie. The Court of Appeals in this particular case was reasonably applying the Pennsylvania versus Ritchie. They said it in different words. They said it was a preliminary showing instead of a plausible showing, but I don't think that's significant. In a sense, almost the Wisconsin standard is more lenient than what Pennsylvania versus Ritchie said, because Pennsylvania versus Ritchie said plausible showing of something that's favorable to the defense and material. And Pennsylvania versus Ritchie defined materiality as a probability of a different result in the case, Wisconsin has not gone that far, and the Court of Appeals in this case didn't go that far. They said a showing of relevance and something that may be necessary for a fair determination of guilt. That, to me, is a more lenient standard even than Ritchie. And so that, unless there are any other questions, the state's position is that they both reasonably applied this holding in Ritchie, and that Ritchie really is the quantum of evidence that is necessary is not clearly established by the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. Time had expired in this case, and therefore will be taken under advisement. And we'll move on to the next case of the day with our thanks to counsel in the